A few years ago, I think it was someone from the archive committee, in fact, Wander, I think it was you, that gave me this little pamphlet entitled that they found The Religion of the Future. It's a lecture that was given to close the Harvard Divinity School summer theology session on July 22nd, 1909. It sat for a while on my desk, and then it found its way into a drawer. And then when I was packing to go to Mexico, I was looking around to see what books or reading material I might bring that would still keep my suitcase under 50 pounds. And I had come across the little pamphlet and going through some papers the day before and set it aside. So I thought, well, it certainly looks light enough, and who knows, it might be a hoot. So I put it in the suitcase, and it went with me. And while instead of being just a curiosity, it drew me in, and I actually read it several times to glean the rich insights it contained, some of which have come to pass in certain sects and denominations, some of which are still in progress. Some parts of the speech feel quite dated, while others seem right on for our own time. In many ways, it defines what much of the journey of Unitarianism and Universalism was all about, especially in the first half of the 20th century. And in some ways, it prescribes where we still need to go. The speech is 23 pages long, but I just want to share a couple of excerpts with you. Religion, Eliot writes, is not a fixed, but a fluent thing. It is therefore wholly natural to be expected that the concepts of religion prevalent among educated people should change from century to century. The religion of the future will not be based on authority, either spiritual or temporal. There will be no worship expressed or implied of dead ancestors, teachers, and no identification of any human being, however majestic, with the eternal deity. In the religion of the future, the primary object will not be the personal welfare or safety of the individual in this world or any other, but our service to others and to the common good. The new religion will not rely on either a sudden conversion in this world or sudden paradise in the next. It will teach that repentance wipes out nothing in the past and is only the first step towards reformation and a sign to a better future. The religion of the future will not perpetuate the anthropomorphic representation of God. The new thought of God will comprehend the Jewish Jehovah, the Christian Universal Father, the modern physicist's omnipresent and exhaustless energy, and the biological concept of vital force. The infinite spirit pervades the universe just as the spirit of man pervades his body and acts on every atom. In this simple and natural faith, there'll be no place for metaphysical complexities or magical rites, much less obscure dogmas. The new religion will animate and guide ordinary men and women who are putting into practice religious concepts which result directly from their own observation and precious experience of tenderness, sympathy, trust, and solemn joy. The future religion will be nothing supernatural. This does not mean that life will be stripped of mystery or wonder, or the range of natural law has been fully defined, but that religion, like all else, must conform to the natural law so far as the range of that law can be determined. In this sense, the religion of the future will be largely a natural religion. It will place no reliance on any sort of magic or miracle. The sacraments will be not invasions of law by miracle, but the visible sign of a natural spiritual grace or a natural hallowed custom. It may preserve historic rites and ceremonies, but it will be content with a natural interpretation of such rites and ceremonies. The new religion will magnify and laud God's love and compassion and not venture to state what justice God may or may not require. The sentiments of awe and reverence and the love of beauty and goodness will remain and increase in strength and influence. The new religion will foster powerfully a virtue which is comparatively new in the world, the love of truth and the passion for seeking it. And the truth will progressively make men free. The religionists will not worship their ancestors, but they will have a stronger sense of the descent of the present from the past than man has ever had before. And each generation will feel more strongly than ever before its indebtedness to the preceding. And the two sentiments which most inspire men to good deeds are love and hope. Religion should give freer and more rational play to these two sentiments than the world has ever before witnessed. And that love and hope will be thoroughly grounded in and on efficient, serviceable, visible, actual, and concrete deeds and conduct. One of our Universalist ancestors, L.B. Fisher, was once asked where Universalists stood on some contentious point of theology. He famously replied, "We don't stand, we move." Indeed, in the rich history of our religious tradition, we have moved a great deal. As you heard in the excerpt from his address given 100 years ago, Charles Eliot also saw religion, quote, not as a fixed, but as a fluent thing. His address essentially was not so much a prediction as it was a prescription on how religion would need to change, in his view, to meet the demands of the 20th century and beyond. The very idea of religion as changeable strikes terror in the hearts of religious conservatives. They believe that revelation is closed. For them, all the answers have been given and all the rules laid down. We see this in those traditions that read the Bible or the Quran literally. We see it in traditions that have authority figures whose wisdom and judgment cannot be questioned. There are still many who believe today that true religion is basically unchangeable. Many of us grew up in traditions that preached, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. As a faith tradition, Unitarian Universalism is really quite different. We are, in fact, uniquely poised to move or to change, as we're not tied to the literal interpretation of any text, nor confined by any dogma. In fact, we have always moved, but not willy-nilly changing in a way that might throw out the baby with the bathwater. Instead, we have moved step by step as the influences of science, philosophy, cultural changes, and new political thinking have entered our movement, and as we understand in new ways the rich teachings of our Judeo-Christian roots and embrace the teachings of other religious traditions as well. As hard as change can be on a personal level, we are a religion which welcomes change, which invites change. And I have to say that this is really, follow Eliot's train, great news for our future. The truth is that many of the changes that Eliot points to in his Harvard address happened within Unitarian Universalism in the 19th and 20th century, and some are still underway. Eliot makes the point so well that a religion must meet the new demands of its time and embrace the new learnings of its generation. Reading his lecture prompted me to think how religion will need to change in order to remain viable in the 21st century. Many other religions have barely even begun to take the first dose of Eliot's prescription for a religion that would meet the demands of the future. Some of them do have individual leaders in their movements that take a non-literal approach to their teachings, their scripture, and their ritual, and are open to welcome into the church the changes that are happening in society. But they have a very tough road to hoe within the tight constraints of still what is, for the most part, a backward-looking hierarchy. My friend and former teacher, John Shelby Spong, a retired bishop of the Episcopal Church, has been threatened with heresy charges by the church hierarchy, and even worse from the diehard traditional laymen, who see his approach, new approach, to both scripture and the customs of the church as a severe threat to the institution. Jack was the first to ordain women and to ordain openly gay people to the Episcopal priesthood. And he was attacked unmercifully for both, even to the point where he was put in physical danger. He's published many best-selling books, including Saving the Bible from Fundamentalism and Why the Church Must Change or Die, which essentially does what Eliot suggests needs to be done to be a religion of the future. And he's received great acclaim from many, but huge resistance within much of the church as well. Often, especially in the South, when he visits an area on a book tour, he will speak at a Unitarian church, not just because he likes us, which he does, but because the Episcopal church in the area will not let him in the door. A few years ago, I observed how that at a wealthy conservative church in Louisville, Kentucky, the priest forbid the congregation to read or to discuss his books. To be a religion for the future will be a real challenge for many of the mainline religions of our time. You know, they are dropping in membership at an astronomical rate right now, and I believe that they will continue to do so unless they quickly begin to embrace at least some of Eliot's advice. A couple of years ago, I read that Methodism was losing 250 members a day and had been for the last 20 years. You can't keep going like that forever. And so many of the followers of Catholicism and mainline Protestantism now say in surveys that they don't really believe what are the core teachings of their faith tradition. They belong to their churches because of tradition or family loyalty, or perhaps because they get an element of human connection and support, and in some cases an opportunity to serve. But having followers who don't believe what their church says is required of them to believe can't be the characteristic of a religion that will thrive in the future. I don't know about you, but I don't want to belong to a religion whose central tenets I don't believe. In time, perhaps over a couple of generations, I think if the institution does not expand its lens to allow for the beliefs that are more consistent with the learning of the time in which their people already hold, surely it will then have an accelerated. That's them. But what about us? Are we really poised to be a religion for the future? In the early days of this country, when people were no longer able or willing to believe the harsh doctrines of Calvinism, when the new thoughts of the Enlightenment and the new thoughts of that growing field we call science began to call into question old teachings, a new religion emerged. And we are that religion. Both Unitarianism and Universalism arose from a refusal by the rigid church of their day to embrace new ideas. And we are still that church. You know, in the early part of the 19th century, Thomas Jefferson predicted that everyone born in that time would die a Unitarian. He believed that then because he saw it as the religion of the future. And we did have great growth in the 19th century to the point by the middle of that century, we were the majority religion in the city of Boston and in much of New England. But a large influx of immigrant communities came to do the work of the factories and also brought with them their own religion, and soon proved Jefferson quite wrong. And I'm not suggesting, as Jefferson did, that everyone would or should become a Unitarian Universalist in the next 100 years. But, you know, we are very fortunate in that we are ahead of the curve in taking on the characteristics, at least those that Eliot describes as the characteristics of a church for the future. We've already laid down the foundation to be that church for the future, but we still have much work to do. We have to learn how to develop community across differences, as someone mentioned, one of the ways we are changing. We have to be more open to ideas across the theological perspective, not putting someone else's theology there. The liberalization of the religion should not be its road to demise, to the feeling that, well, it's no longer necessary for our time. Instead, it should bring about an invigoration of religious experience, a new revival, if you will, not based on the old drive to personal salvation in some afterlife, but a drive to be part of a rich and full experience that brings out the best in us in this life. Interestingly, this week I received a letter from the president of our denomination, Peter Morales, and some of you actually may have read parts of it because Helen Jones sent out some of it in a FPC announcement, Denominational Affairs. The letter raises some interesting points and questions about how this movement will engage with people in the future. It outlines some of his ideas for the future of Unitarian Universalism, and in his words, gives a, quote, strategic direction consistent with our values and our historic willingness to push beyond predetermined boundaries. He points out something we have known for a long time, and that is that many, many more people identify as Unitarian Universalists than actually belong to Unitarian Universalist churches. In fact, studies have shown that figure to be in excess of 500,000 people. Yet we are by definition a congregationally based religion. And in fact, there is no way in our present structure of membership to be a Unitarian Universalist without belonging to a congregation. You can be in sympathy with our values, uphold our principles, accept our common beliefs, but today that's not enough to be officially counted as a Unitarian Universalist. President Morales writes, I envision a UU movement that is composed of a mix of congregations and a variety of other structures. People should be able to connect to our religious movement in a variety of ways and at different levels of commitment. Some people would concentrate on spirituality in small groups. Some, a lot probably, would get involved in justice issues like marriage equality, environmental justice, and immigration reform. Other groups would be identity-based, like Spanish language groups, or seminarians and religious professionals of color. We cannot predict the groups that would form, or which ones would be the most valuable. And he goes on to say, the UUA's role would be to provide a container, the technological foundation, leadership, and coordination. We become a resource, a platform, and a hub. This is not just about developing a set of programs, but finding a way for us to learn a new way as an institution. The future relevance of our faith may well depend on whether we can create a religious movement beyond as well as within parish. You know, some of his ideas are already in play. You may know we have in our association now what's called the Church of the Larger Fellowship, which is essentially an electronic church with online worship services and even pastoral care. It is growing, and several thousand people belong to it as their church. And I'm sure that he's right that we need to use the technology of our time to reach out to new people in new ways. We need to use organizations other than just parishes to connect people. We need to lead them into deeper and more meaningful lives and to unite them with the work of justice through a variety of means. Essentially, what I believe he's saying, though, is that we need a wider door into Unitarian Universalism. And I fully agree, and I'm sure any religion of the future needs to embrace the incredible electronic media connections of the 21st century. But that's just the beginning of what our faith for the future needs to be. We need more than a tease that will hold folks' interests or even hold them in some project for a short time. The religion of the future must bring people into deep and meaningful and lasting connections. As the theme of our campaign says, the religion of the future needs to be constantly building connections. The long-term human connections that only a congregation can provide is essential. This kind of intentional community is life-giving and life-saving and is likely to be needed even more in the future than it is now. You know, with all the technological advances, in some ways people are becoming more and more isolated. You've probably heard the statistics indicating that Americans are suffering from a loss in the quality and quantity of close, meaningful friendships, connections. The number as of 2006 had dropped from 4 close connections or friends to 2. And I recently read somewhere that it's now below 1. With more and more people working from home or working in their own little cubicle with families dispersed around the country and often moving, having a church where you can find true community, where you can step into it, where you can create what theologians call the beloved community, I believe will be even more essential in the future than it is now in the present. What I mean by that is captured in some words by the Unitarian theologian Clarence Skinner. He writes, "The beloved community is not an organization of individuals seeking private and selfish security for their own souls. It is a new adventure, a spontaneous fellowship of consecrated men and women seeking a new world. The beloved community is not just a place where we come together to discuss theology or the issues of the day. It is not just a place where we reach into our social action, where we reach out in social action in service to others. Primarily, it is the spirit of love made real in human fellowship." That's what the church of the future must do. Our church of the future will also need to build deeper spiritual connections. People yearn to feel a real connection to their authentic self. And that yearning, I don't think, is going to go away. Our church of the future must cultivate theological reflection by facilitating the individual quest for truth and meaning. That church will need to remind us that although our scientific knowledge of the world may be different, we share the same universal questions our ancestors explored in their time. And in their discoveries, there is still wisdom for us today, too. The gospel of hope and love, of universal justice, of fairness, of oneness, the profound connection of all things, must be preached and applied to issues of the new day with even greater fervor. And we must provide people concrete ways to live out their faith and deeds. The church of the future will continue to embrace life mysteries and inspire awe and reverence. The church will be a church of great freedom. Freedom from the bonds that bind the mind to narrow thoughts and lifeless creeds. Freedom to engage in a daring and unbounded search for truth. We must be that church which, yes, reveres the past, but trusts the dawning future more. We've laid the groundwork. We've not stood still and unchanging like many other traditions. We are, in fact, poised to be a religion.